Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Tom, if you could eat dinner with anyone, who would you eat with?
Ooh, good question. Greg Popovich, coach of the Spurs. Like, whatever I'm drinking that night is going to be fantastic, and that's going to lubricate some really good stories. I'd always like to eat with Padma. Richard Blaise would be a lot of fun, and I think the other one I'd like to have dinner with is Guy Fieri. What about you?
I'm going way back. Why not the Buddha? Otama himself. Like, you know he's got a big appetite, because everywhere around the world where there is, you know, a shrine to him, there is, like, cookies and stuff. Look at that figure. And, I mean, I don't think we'd be eating a lot of meat, which would be one issue, but, you know. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz. Tom, getting into it, a little contentiousness. It's becoming a more interesting season as we weed it out. We've got snails. We've got Frenchmen. We got all kinds of stuff.
We have a double elimination here, Kevin. This is a weighty quickfire. And, you know, we say goodbye to two chefs this episode. We also see a preview for next episode where Tom Colicchio is throwing out, spitting out some food. And I vaguely remember this. But it seems like we're reaching... We've weeded out some of the contestants here, and I just think at this stage of the game, we're seeing the creme de la creme. We're seeing that the Voltaggio brothers, Kevin Gillespie and Jen Carroll have really separated themselves, and this episode I think showed just as much.
Yeah, for me, this episode really posed the grand question of casting. Of Top Chef. There's something obviously to be said about watching amazing chefs, like world-class, top three finisher quality chefs square off in an all-star season, right? We saw this most recently in season 17, and that's great. I also wonder, for sheer television, if it's not better to have a crop at the top, but also have, you know, and I don't want to knock the chef, less experienced, you know, maybe less skills that are less conducive to this particular game. But the, you know, in some ways, their disaster in the kitchen does produce better moments. I think we all watch competition shows with a little bit of Schadenfreude. I think it's just part of a competition. I mean, you go and you root for a team and you root against the other team, or you just kind of want to see what materializes. And it's sort of, you know, looking back at season six and watching it informed by the idea that it's Tom's favorite, that it's, you know, I think it was the award winner, among junkies, it is considered one of the best, if not the best season. And watching some of the chefs struggle, you know, is that struggle necessary for, you know, perfect entertainment? Or is it better when we just sit there mouth agape, marveling at every single contestant? Rarely is there a screw up. Really good dishes go home. I mean, it's, I think this is one of the definitive questions.
Well, I think I stumbled upon something that I didn't realize existed, which is Tom Colicchio did a blog during this season. And some of the posts are still archived. And so I found I found a post from Tom about this episode, and it actually talks about some of the casting for this season that I found particularly interesting. The first thing he noted is, I get it. The first four contestants that went home were not men. And people, I guess, at that time were very upset about this, or at least he probably got a couple emails, and Twitter wasn't in existence at this point, or social media really wasn't on fire at this point. So I don't know how he would have gotten the criticism at that point, but maybe the websites or people who are recapping the show, whether it was food sites, whatnot, were like, hey, we saw Jesse, Preeti, Jen, Z eliminated, and also Eve eliminated, and not one of them were men. And he talked about the fact that in the restaurant industry, there is systemic inequities that make men have higher positions or more. There are more chefs in the restaurant world than there are women chefs. And so Tom said, we always have an equal amount on both sides there, and trying to make sure that, you know, there's not 15 dudes on the show and two women. Every year they have an equal amount. And this year he said, you know, with Hector going home, we'll talk about this later, that was the first male who went home. And he said, look, we judge every dish on its own merit. And it's just a numbers game, is that the talent pool that we get at Top Chef, the casting directors get far more male chefs being submitted to the Top Chef applicant pool, and therefore just a higher level of talent are brought in just by sheer statistics. So I thought that was interesting. But we know, after watching several years of Top Chef, women kick ass on this show. And so I think this is just a little small sample size theater where it just so happened that none of the men went home in the first four episodes. And here we see, you know, Tom addressing it in his blog post on Bravo.com. And I thought that was interesting. What are your thoughts on that?
One thing I've always wanted to see, and I don't know, and I have to jog my memory, tell me if I'm missing, I'd love to see one elimination challenge in a future season be blind. In other words, just have servers come out with the dishes, you know, two at a time, set them down. There's a written little blurb from each dish, from each chef about their dish. I'd like it to be earlier in the season before Tom and Padma, who obviously are really good at this, can probably identify. I mean, you know a Brian Beltaggio dish when you see it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that would be a really interesting experiment. For years, Lincoln Center, or was it the Met? I forget, but in New York, always did blind auditions. And the idea was to create more equitability at a time when, you know, I think the people judging the potential musicians looked and had the same experiences as many of the auditioners,
right,
and were maybe prone to, you know, being more selective with women, with people of color. There's actually a conversation about reversing that now, but I wonder, that is one thing I would love to see. Again, early in a season, is just what happens if the chefs do this blind? And look, that's tricky because there's this suggestion now that these judges are informed by who's setting the plate down. Do they
harbor some subliminal biases that they just they're not aware of?
Right. Like if somebody they perceive as a top chef, delivers a clunker, do they offer an exception there where they wouldn't for a chef who's been struggling? But that would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
Early in a season where you say, let's start with seven women, seven men. I do think recent seasons have been much more inclusive, and we've seen that. And frankly, it's also played out at the top of the heat as well. I mean, we've had seasons recently with where the finales have been, you know, the final four or five have been dominated.
Yeah, Melissa and Kelsey, and then Sarah in that season with Kelsey. It's certainly, you know, this particular topic at this particular juncture in season six, I think is interesting because even in that bottom three in the quickfire, there were no men there. And so let's get into the episode here. The first quickfire was interesting, not just because of the elimination impact, the elimination aspect of it, but where was Padma?
Yeah. Where was Padma? You know what? It's so funny you say that. I haven't really thought about it.
You know,
were they less, rigid with that? I mean, I can't, I mean, so long ago. Was it a regular thing where Tom would maybe step in?
Now that I think about it, I just remember watching this and seeing, I felt like Tom was a little off. Like he was delivering the quick fire and he didn't seem like a natural at it. And then it occurred to me that usually it's Padma doing that. And so he's announcing the quick fire and the stakes involved and, you know, it's going to be escargot. And it just occurred to me that it's become a Padma thing. And maybe I'm thinking about this incorrectly, but it seemed like out of the ordinary that we have Tom doing a quickfire.
Also, you know, I've really loved, as you have, Last Chance Kitchen the last few years. I do, you know, Tom is always at his most Tom-ish when he's up on high, right? I mean, even literally that judge's table, I think, is elevated. And yeah, getting down in the weeds is less his element. Now this week it was kind of interesting because he had, it was Daniel Balud.
Yeah.
Who is an absolute, sort of an absolute legend. And escargot was the protein. And by the way, Jen Carroll is so winning because I just like she has this ability to give you good information and make it funny. Like snails are a delicate protein. And whoever thought snails were something to eat must have been really fucking hungry.
Yes.
You know, and so, you know, Jen Carroll is so winning in this season. I'd forgotten. She had a couple rough bumps in recent seasons in terms of elimination. And you just forget just A, how dominant she was, and B, just how much fun it was. So, yeah, anyway, it's I just love her. Early in the season.
Yeah, she has so much conviction, and she's everything she says is super sharp. And I want to say that when you look at the fact that she was last week the point guard in the kitchen and then comes into this and just, I don't know, she's a juggernaut. And then you also look at the fact that the setup here, you would think would give Mateen a leg up because of the fact that he's French, and that he, you know, it's not like he comes in and you can't really tell that he's French. He has a very strong French accent, and so I'm wondering, Kevin, when he's going up against French chefs, do you see that as an advantage or a disadvantage? Because hey, he really better be stepping up to the plate.
I mean, I guess in terms of exotation, it's a disadvantage. But at the same time, I would imagine a French chef has been schooled in traditional French cooking. And I mean, there is, you would think it's an advantage.
Yeah. And Mateen, look, I don't know much about escargot. He says he grew up on escargot, which sure. I can't remember the first time I ever had escargot, but it was basically, I really liked it because it was smothered in garlic and butter, right? Like, I think people like escargot because it's just a butter bomb, right? And in Tom Colicchio's blog post, he mentioned that what didn't make the air, Kevin, is that they told the chefs on the show, please don't do a garlic butter sauce. Like, think of something more inventive, think outside the box, and do something that isn't necessarily your classic escargot with in those little cups with butter and garlic. So I think that's the issue, that one of the things when you're looking at a Top Chef challenge, you're immediately going to escargot garlic butter sauce. We didn't see too much of that in this, and I'll appreciate it.
And this is why I think Isabella was on top, or in the top three. You know what? He essentially did that. It was a garlic puree, a little ouzo broth, just to kind of, you know, give it a little bit of a personal signature. And, you know, Jen did grilled ramps. It was funny. This was the actual challenge wasn't to do escargot. There's always a subtext to the challenge. And this challenge was don't make it fancy. Like, just, you know, generally keep it simple. I mean, I think Kevin was probably the one departure from that, because he did his fricassee with a candied bacon jam. By the way, as on brand as a quick fire dish can be. Like
yes. Yeah,
Kevin Gillespie doing a fricassee of snails with candied bacon jam. Bless his heart. I mean, it's just and then the ones who you know failed were, you know, bagels and lox, which was very weird because I looked at that dish and I couldn't see the bagels and loxness as somebody who was like I was nursed on bagels and lox. Yeah, like that is you know, and then you had, you know, Jesse with the escargot LT, you know, the BLT. Like, there's a theme here, which is, you know, don't make a sandwich out of escargot. And finally, Ashley, who just had a really difficult week. Perhaps hers was too simple, kind of the mirepoix soup with escargot and a salad. There was something a little sad about that dish. And those were the three bottoms. But you know, that was actually the actual challenge is, let's see how restrained you can be without trying. You're going to try to be, your instinct is going to be creative with this, frankly, for as much, and I think Jen Carroll essentially said this, is for as much as, ooh, it's exotic, escargot. It's like a gumdrop that doesn't taste like anything. Like it is a delivery system for garlic and butter, as you said.
You know, Kevin, they, another thing, like this Colicchio blog is amazing, said that they didn't have time to cook the escargot, the snails, because of the fact that it takes so long to cook snails correctly. So what they did is all the snails that they used were pre-cooked. And so their job was to essentially dress it up and make it a really good dish. It's already pre-cooked. And so that really made them have to think, like, what kind of dressing? I don't have to even think about cooking the snail. I just have to really think about the background to this dish. And Kevin Gillespie's bacon jam was so good that Tom went home after shooting that episode and started working on a bacon jam himself, because he loved that dish so much that he went to the workshop, went to the lab, and started working on his own bacon jam that could be inspired by Kevin Gillespie's dish. So it was you know what I loved about this quickfire, Kevin, was that it was a Last Chance Kitchen. Maybe this was kind of the beginnings of Last Chance Kitchen, which was like, hey, you're voted. You could be voted off here, but you're going to get another shot. What you're going to do is do a dish that is an amuse-bouche and come back, and that's going to be what sends you – what's going to decide whether you stay or go. And I kind of love that. Was like, we kind of saw the embryonic stages of Last Chance Kitchen here.
I didn't even think about that. That's totally true. Also, it was interesting. Again, one of the things I love about watching this old season is just picking up the culinary trends of that moment. Gooseberries is everywhere, right? Like there was that sort of gooseberry moment in the late aughts. You start seeing yuzu being utilized in a very both specific and general way. And it was kind of the amuse-bouches were a bit underwhelming. I guess they only had 20 minutes. And again, I'm still amazed at what these chefs can do in 20 minutes. I was concerned for Ashley just because it didn't really look like an amuse. It just looked like a very small version of a full plate. Amuse to me is always like this one bite, right?
One bite.
It comes in a little shot glass, or it just is, you can pick it up with your fingers. And you know, Ashley's, her foie gras was sort of with pineapple was just like, it was a real dish, an actual appetizer that was reduced in size, whereas Jesse's tuna tartare, which she went home with a fried quail leg, which actually looked really good.
It looked awesome, yeah, it looked Kevin. Really I was like, man, if that was an Instagram post, it would win. I feel like it was a beautiful crafted dish, and I saw that and I said, oh, she's not going home.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm actually someone. This will sound like an expression of self-regard, is I don't like to see the chefs suffer. Like, I don't watch with any schadenfreude unless somebody's a real asshole and you know, and they get what's coming. But it has been so sad to watch Jesse just since that first quick fire, just ever since then, the self-doubt. And I have just a great deal of empathy for her, but it's just not something you see much anymore. Occasionally you have self-deprecation. We saw it with Stephanie, little self-doubt. Wow, I'm up against really accomplished chefs. But like it was almost a mercy killing because she has been just so dejected. And again, not something you see on current seasons nearly as much.
No. And maybe we're just recency bias coming off of the Top Chef All-Stars, but there's so much more confidence in that season because they're much more accomplished, right? And they've already done the show. Whereas Jessie, you could even see the tears in her eyes as she's in the bottom three again, because she's been there before many times. And Jessie right now, I checked this, where are they now? Top Chef style is Jessie is opening a new restaurant in Baltimore, where she's from. Jesse Sandlin is at Jesse Pancakes on Instagram, and she's opening up a restaurant in Baltimore called Sally O's. So next time I'm in Baltimore, maybe going to Camden Yards, if they're going to still have a season, checking out Sally O's. Jesse is best of luck. She's a chef and owner of that restaurant.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, it's again, it's been 12 years. So, in Baltimore is sort of, it's, again, I mean, you know, so I hate to say it every week, but you just feel for chefs who are, you know, opened in late 19 or were trying to open this year, because like, who knows what's going on there. Yeah. I just can't imagine. We're already seeing like places that were doing really well, top of the heap, critical favorites, just shut down for good now in Los Angeles. And it's just like, here's Looking at You, which is one of my absolute favorites in town. Gone. Just gone. And there are others as well. And it's just, it's going to be terrifying when all of this clears to see what's left. And the smoldering ashes of food scenes in your city, in my city, around the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Best of luck to Jesse on opening Sally O's in Baltimore. Kevin, did you notice Tom Colicchio's send-off line? Pack your knives and leave.
What do you mean? Wait. Go again?
When Tom Colicchio said, pack your knives and go to Jesse.
He said, yes, pack your knives and leave. Yeah. Which
I was like, oh, wait, Padma's not here. Maybe that was the moment when I realized Padma was not there.
No, it was like, it's like, I don't know, when you were a kid, like when like mom was away and dad had to do breakfast, you know? Yeah. And so like, so my dad's thing was to sort of make it work for us when mom was away. And yes, there were traditional gender roles at my house growing up. Was, you know, the pancake batter in like the milk quart, you know, which was sort of utilized in the 80s. So he would do the pancakes in the shape of our initials. So I would get a K and my sister would get an S. And this was sort of his way of putting his personal signature quite literally on breakfast. But that was very much this episode, right? Like, like Padma's away and Tom is sort of the substitute teacher. But, you know, I'll have to watch for that. I don't remember. I guess it is. It's a convention since, maybe season two, that Padma always does quickfire.
Look, maybe it was a late night out in Vegas. Who knows? And this was an early, maybe it was an early morning and Tom was up. Who knows? But this was.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Big win for Kevin. Isabella and Jen Carroll also in the top. You know, Kevin wins this. He doesn't get he gets immunity, but on top of that, what a pleasure that must have been. Not just the release of I don't have to compete and I can just take the night off, but you get to sit down with the best chefs in the world at your dinner table so early in the season.
Yeah, I mean, so it was, you know, Laurent Tarandel. It was Hubert Keller, who has an uncanny resemblance to Killer Bob. A reference that might predate you, Tom.
It is.
Killer
it
Bob is. Was Please the villain on the first season of Twin Peaks. And the first season of Twin Peaks at the time was probably the most innovative television ever to appear on network TV. And he looked like Killer Bob. He just did. he was kind of freaky. And Joelle Robuchon, who actually died a couple of years ago, but is considered just the godfather of kind of modern French cuisine. Taking the traditional, in a sense, this was a very Robuchon challenge, which is take the traditional French dishes and put a twist on them, retain the authenticity of the dish, but give it your own voice. Kevin sitting there, a 26-year-old Kevin Gillespie dining with this particular group is so awesome. It is vicarious living at its best. Right. And you could, again, every once in a while on Top Chef, there's a moment where you can just revel in the sheer joy of one of the contestants.
Yeah.
And it was like, He didn't say a word on screen all night. Like he was just, which is what you do, right? I mean, you're sitting at the table of the legends. You just soak up it's just an immersive experience. And yeah, that was really cool.
Was
I was
like
really
little,
happy.
Little child there. He was just so giddy. It was like watching someone meet their favorite baseball player as a kid. It was so cool to watch. And I had read that Kevin had to buy Bravo had to buy a suit for him. because they don't bring suits to this show. It's Top Chef. They don't bring a full-blown suit. So they went out and bought him a suit, and he has to sit down with this just Hall of Fame lineup. And I'm not particularly steeped in French cooking, Kevin. So I had to learn a little bit about the different techniques here. Which one of the techniques were you most excited about, or the sauces for this episode?
I mean, I think like the rabbit with chasseur, just because I never heard of that. I mean, now I know, like when they said the chasseur is basically a brown sauce with demi glace. I was like, oh yeah, I think I've seen that before, but mm-hmm. you know, I it's funny now, I don't eat mammals this year. So, but I'd always aspired to cook rabbit. Even though like it does remind me of Fatal Attraction, it's just like, there is something a little bit off about cooking rabbit. It just seems like they're really cute in a way that cows aren't or elk or, you know, any of the other sort of, you know, non-conventional proteins. But I was kind of excited also because it was Jen and Mike Voltaggio.
Oh man.
Like major, you know, it was funny to see, I mean, most of the dishes did have an obvious pairing, like Chateaubriand and peppercorn, obviously you're going there, lobster and lobster sauce. Then there were sort of some interesting, I mean, I think you could argue that the Poisson could have gone with that chasseur, and you could have switched it up, rabbit with velouté or whatever, but I was sort of excited. Also, I was kind of wanted to see what Ron would do with frog legs, which actually the restaurant aforementioned, Here's Looking at You, which I love, that's closing in Los Angeles, did a XO sauce frog leg, which is one of their better dishes. So, it was just going to be interesting to see. I wanted to see kind of what Mateen would do, just because it's a home game for him, at least theoretically. And yeah, I mean, it's an interesting challenge. It's one of my favorite challenges because it's like, hey, take the classics. There are these parameters, but you got to put a personal signature on it, which is actually harder than just bringing one of your dishes from home. Because let's face it, we've talked about it. We've talked about it with contestants. You know, a lot of times, you know, they've sort of have their mental catalog. They know what they're going to if given the chance to have, you know, a moment of personal expression in the kitchen. And this was, no. This is what you're doing. And now, you know, within these confines, do the personal challenge.
I love watching Michael Voltaggio work, because he's got like in the interviews, he's got like his backwards hat, and he just kind of looks like a Linkin Park, like groupie. He just looks like he when he talks, he talks shit, and he's, but then when you get him doing food, or when you get him in the kitchen, he is a machine. Yeah. And when he's deconstructing that that rabbit, and just with the hacks, just boom, 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 he was on another level. And I just respect the hell out of Michael Voltaggio, because everything he puts out, it looks like he's been thinking about this dish, and he's been getting that elimination challenge or whatever challenge it was for years. That he has gotten like the cheat code of how to make this dish. And watching him and Jen, it's like they've been, you know, Tony Parker and Tim Duncan running the pick and roll forever.
Yeah, they had such an appealing intensity. You know, they're different brands of intensity on a reality competition show. There is intensity that manifests itself in sheer freneticism, like chicken without a head. There is intensity that can be really aggressive toward others. I talk, you listen. And then there was this appealing brand of intensity with the two of them. And we're going to talk about this a lot on the show, but I do feel like this was the moment in the course of the series where a new ceiling was set. Like, Michael Voltaggio set the standard for championship. You know, it's just there was a new baseline after season six. And I wonder if that, when people like Colicchio talk about the season as being just crucial, pivotal, and seminal in the overall success of the show, I wonder if that's sort of part of it, which is, okay, this is for real. Like, look at this guy play. I mean, again, like Jordan, somebody who comes on the scene, not just is better than anyone who came before them, but redefines the terms and standards of the game itself. I also love Jen working with him, right? Like, he's hacking that rabbit. She's going to do the demi-glace. It's, you know, and by the way, and she was so respectfully deferential, but also was going to make, like, was an equal contributor in the overall success. I just had forgotten how appealing Jen's intensity was. It's one of my favorite things about this season.
Yeah, and then also Mike's brother, Brian, with the Bernays sauce. This was such a classic Brian dish, right?
It is, like, the most Brian-looking dish ever. Like, they cure the trout. It's this beautifully cut. And Isabella, give him credit. I mean, he kind of played a Brian game, which is let's deconstruct the Bernays. And by the way, like, how do you – I mean, my first impression was, how the hell – what, it's eggs and butter. Like, what are you going to do? Put a hard-boiled egg and, like, just a pat of butter. Like, how do you even deconstruct this? And they did the raw egg yolk. Like, that to me, in some ways, like, my sense was is the rabbit was the best tasting dish. I was most impressed in terms of interpretation with the trout and Bernays. Again, just like Michael's dish, Brian's dish looks like the most Brian dish you could ever see. Just the small, shapely components on the dish. Like, I love looking, you know, it was such a, you know, the simple becomes exceptional. That was the point of the challenge, and he did it.
Yes. And I had to look this up. The difference between a Bernays and a Hollandaise sauce. Okay. So a Bernays sauce is, I mean, both of them, you're emulsifying butter and egg yolks and you mix in some acidity. In a Bernays sauce, all right, in a Hollandaise sauce, which is more classic, came before a Bernays, a Hollandaise, you throw in lemon juice. In a Bernays, you actually use white wine vinegar, throw in some fresh herbs, and some shallots. So that's the difference between a Bernays and a Hollandaise. And apparently, Brian had to walk Isabella through that and just like, no, this is how a Bernays is done. And so even though he came up with the cured trout, and I think he sous vide it, and the technique is instead of just sous vide a fillet of trout, which would just turn it into mush, he cured it beforehand, which injects some more flavors and actually keeps it together. So it cooks it a little bit more before you throw in the sous vide. And just the technique and the conception, like conceiving that dish. Oh my God, what an amazing job by Brian. And I had to ask you, Kevin, about this because I don't know if this is cheating, but there does seem a little bit of a shortcut element to what happened to Hector and also with Brian. Where do you fall on using like a machine to cook food and just setting it and forgetting it, to use that infomercial?
Yeah, I kind of felt for this team and for the sole reason that it's really hard to cook in ovens and machines that aren't yours. Like, so something I've learned about my oven, which I bought in 2017, it runs hot, right? If it calls for 400, I'm going 385, right? Mm. And because I overcooked enough in that oven where it's like, what the fuck? Like, I'm, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty cut and dry. Like, I'm to put this, you know, chop in for X amount, you know? And so, like, the thing with Hector is it was one of those, well, what the fuck are we supposed to do? And you saw that consternation in his face. Like, I know how to do this, man. The thing's not cooked. Like, what am I supposed to fucking do? If I take it out too early, it's going to be too rare and because you need to rest it. If I take it out too late, it's not going to have enough time to rest and it's going to lose its juices, right? And so, like, they're up there beating the shit out of him on the chopping block, right? Like, he's up there on the chopping block and so are Ashley and my team for their poussin with velouté, which, like, Mateen just totally bricked. But I'm up there and you know, and Gail's sitting there saying, you hacked my meat to death. And you could see him. Like, I had 2 minutes to cut 14 slices.
Bless,
like,
his heart, Kevin. Like, Hector was so noble, and he was I just want to give him a big hug.
Yeah. And it's like, and by the way, the chefs who were judging him were correct, right? Like, Chateaubriand was the easiest of the six proteins to work with. I mean, you saw it. All it takes is, you know, a pretty good roast. And I just felt for him because, like, what are you – like, that oven clearly is not the oven he's accustomed to working on. Who knew that it was going to run cooler the way mine runs hotter? And I don't know that there's anything else you can do.
Yeah.
Other than, hey, you needed to get it in earlier, right? Like, I mean, the one thing you could say is, hey, look, man, you don't know this instrument. You don't know what it's going to do or not do. Just get by yourself, you know, get yourself 10, 15 minutes of cushion at the front. You think it's going to take X time with, you know, this thickness and this cut, but you need to leave some wiggle room in case you make a wrong turn. And then my guess is the peppercorn sauce, just because that meat was drained of its juices and that those, they were all over the plate. You pour that sauce on, it just kind of, it just, you know, mingles with that juice, and which means it gets totally diluted and you don't really have, you know, the flavor. It was a disaster. Right. I like, unlike other disasters, like it didn't seem as if it were in self-inflicted as the Poussin Vilité.
I'm with you. Yep. And I think Hector going home, I felt really bad because it wasn't really in his control, but the thermometer that he used to try to get to the right temperature, maybe that was running low or running cold or running hot. And so my only critique on top of what you said is maybe if you're going to err on the side of caution, don't overcook a filet or the Chateaubriand. Don't overcook it. I'd rather undercook it and then have it rest. And that may maybe have been a margin for error that would have saved him. But who knows? I mean, you also in that audience, that peanut gallery of like the top chefs in the world, no pun intended, maybe you don't want to go under. You want to make sure that it's cooked correctly. So that was difficult to watch. And I actually thought Mateen, not his best performance in this episode. Huh?
Yeah. By the way, we haven't seen that he can do much. I mean, I don't mean to knock it, but he's been an underwhelming contestant so far. They kind of went wrong in every respect. It was sort of the opposite wrongness of the Chateaubriand peppercorn team. First of all, the Velouté, which is overly baconed. It was very sort of disappointing to see him essentially lie when
he lied.
Yeah,
straight up.
Ashley, kind of in the Whole Foods, was, hey, maybe some asparagus for the Velouté. He claims Frenchness and says, no, it's a terrible additive to Velouté. Let's just do a little bacon. And it would have brightened up that sauce that was just overly, you know, Tom's funny. That was an era in cooking where everything's better with bacon. That late aughts bacon on everything, period. And he said, yeah, this is one exception. And then, you know, apparently the Poussin was dry. The ravioli was dry. I thought it was actually a well thought out dish in terms of, hey, that's a fun way to mm-hmm. do a sauce encased in a piece of ravioli. But disaster. And again, we saw like, and I respect Ashley. I mean, she kind of almost let go of the rope. I think she thought she was going home, and you know, wasn't going to call out. I mean, there's nothing worse than like, what do you do when your partner at the chopping block either lies, throws you under the bus? Like, if you fight, you look petty. You know, if you don't fight, you sort of look like a doormat, and then you can't also defend yourself. I mean, you know, what if she says, look, motherfucker, he, or like, hey, to the judges, this asshole is lying his ass off. We stood there right in the aisle of the Whole Foods. I suggested we introduce some asparagus into the velouté. He said, nah. You know, like I just wonder. Look, the other way, she didn't go home. And I think they detected who was the more responsible party, because yeah, the velouté was the least favorite part of the dish. But still, I don't know how, like, how would you react, Tom? You're standing next to your partner. Your partner is just outright lying or omitting important information about what went down. You were, in terms of fault, it should be distributed 80% them, 20% you. What do you do? Do you defend yourself? Do you do a half defense? Do you get down in the mud? I mean, what do you do?
I think I read the room. I look at the other contestants, and if it seems like I'm the lowest on the totem pole there, and my head is on the chopping block, I'm defending and I'm putting up a fight. If I'm reading the room and seeing that, hey, they're not believing Mateen's bullshit, then I'm not going to put up a huge fight. If they can see through whatever he's claiming, and if he's got the magnifying glass under him and in the spotlight, I feel like I might just let him, you know, ruin his day on his own. And I think she could have gotten much stronger and defending herself and saying, hey, no, you're fucking lying, right? but it might have come off petty. And I don't think Mateen was all that persuasive. And so she probably looked at that situation and said, it's not worth it. He's actually, he's making his own bed here and he's going to get bounced. Yeah. But also I can't remember the sequence. Did Hector and Ash go first in terms of their critiques? And then I think
they were second. Ash? Yeah. I think they were second.
Right. So she might've seen that, look, they're going home. That's the losing team. So it's not going to be me or Mateen. So that's kind of how I would feel. If they were getting critiqued first and it was clear that Mateen was winning over the judges table, I would definitely put up my fist and fight back. But at that point, Ashley obviously made the right move because she didn't go home. But you still, there's a lot of strategy there. It's almost like at the last second, you know, a last possession play, a guy breaks up the play and hijacks the offense and takes the shot. And at one point you want to just say like, hey, pass me the ball. The game was supposed to go to me. The play was supposed to go to me. But maybe Ashley looked at that and said, you know what? He's not going to hit that shot. So let him fucking miss. If he wants to hijack this thing, he's going to go home for it. And I think that's what happened there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how I would play it because it's easy to sit here and try to, when the bright lights aren't on and you're up there on the chopping block, basically you're looking at a firing squad. I wonder if there's a way just to say, hey, listen, it is not in my nature to throw anybody under the bus or get down in the mud and have one of those petty arguments in front of the judges. You guys deserve better. But I also can't let, you know, an untruth just sit here. And the bottom line is I had suggested asparagus as a component in making the velouté, and Mateen rejected it. I'm fine with him rejecting it, but what I'm not fine with is him lying about it. And I wonder if you say it like that. And again, it's very easy for me to sit here and script it when you're, you know, up there sweating bullets and you're looking at, you know, your Top Chef death. But yeah, by the way, one of the funnier things is like and you've talked about it in previous episodes, and it'll probably lessen over the next few weeks just because there are fewer contestants. But like there were people whose quickfire we didn't even see. Like we saw Ron put down his dish in the quickfire, and then we never heard him talk about it. We never heard them talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
Which my interpretation was it was squarely in the middle, right?
Yeah.
You know, his frog legs. I really felt for Ron in this dish. You know, I mean, he talked about, I mean, you know, I'm thinking of the Haitian Rebellion of the early 1800s and just how jobbed Haiti was by France during colonial times. And I mean, they were vicious. And actually, there's some wonderful stories of sort of Haitian rebellion and their military leaders and, you know, the fight for independence. But, you know, he's stuck with this protein and, you know, he's cooking for these colonialists and, you know, and he did okay. And I was happy to see them acknowledge. I think, you know, and again, I've never cooked with frogs.
That pretext, it didn't occur to me. So I'm glad you brought that
up. And, you know, I was happy to see the judges at least acknowledge that. And again, I've never cooked with it, but that frog legs are really difficult. And they didn't do poorly, but also didn't do well. They were complimented for their conception of the dish. And I was glad to see they were spared, finishing in the third, fourth range with Eli and Lorene in their lobster, dish.
And a nice job by Magical Elves here. I thought that Robin in the opening, when she was talking about like, I want to show up for the girls because three girls have been sent home. I was like, uh-oh. This is not looking good. And then they showed how much discord there was between Ron and her trying to figure out at Whole Foods what they were going to do. And Ron was saying, you know, I think if there was a contestant, no one would want to work with Robin because she's all over the place. I thought that this was Robin going home from the start. And so bravo, no pun intended, Magical Elves, well done there, because it totally duped me. I thought Robin was going to be on her way out, and instead it was Hector who no handshakes. I don't know if this is something new, but you typically see like pack your knives and go, thank you, really really appreciate being here, appreciate everything, and then they go like handshake with the judges to bid adieu. Not this time. They just kind of cut to Hector walking out. And I really felt bad for Hector on this one. He's an Atlanta chef, Kevin. So did you kind of look up anything on Hector?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew he was an Atlanta chef. I don't know that his place is still running. Did you do a Where Are They Now?
Yes, I did, Kevin. So he is at he's doing like a pop-up right now called El Burro Pollo, which is in the Ponce City Market.
Oh, Ponce City Market is great. My sister lives like a third of the mile from there. It's where we walk from her house. Just it's a wonderful. They have a food hall. It's in an old, I believe it's in like the old Sears, like big warehousey thing where they retrofitted for that. And Ponce City Market is wonderful. And that's good to know. I will check it because I am always at Ponce City Market when I go home. Poor guy. I'm seeing here that the story about the opening is March 13th. So we're talking about 5 days before the shutdown. Man, these chefs, I can't imagine. It's just awful. Some closing thoughts, Tom?
Can't wait for next week. We have the desert heat. They have to cook outside. Vaguely remember this. Vaguely remember Tom spitting out a dish. You know what? We should start bringing on some of the chefs here, Kevin.
We really should.
Because some of these scenes, in retrospect, I bet they have some stories to tell. And
also, given that we're removed 12 years, I suspect they're okay telling them.
Yeah. The statute of limitations is over by now. So one quote stuck out to me this episode from Gail saying, "I don't think we could have had this good of a meal this early in any season than this season." And Gail is right. These chefs, the French chefs coming in this early in a season is a huge risk for Top Chef because it could have been a disaster. You know, this early in the season, you really haven't weeded out too many of the chefs. And so it could be almost a disrespectful meal for these traditional French giants, right? But in this season, with the juggernauts that we have here, it seemed like they were extremely pleased with what they put up today.
My closing thought is some reading recommendations. It's a piece that actually has been around for a few weeks now, but Matt Golding, who's a wonderful food writer, one of the founders of Roads and Kingdom, which is like I think he co-founded with Anthony Bourdain. If you are somebody who loves food and travel as a means of eating and eating as a means of traveling, it's a wonderful publication online. Goulding's been a wonderful food writer, and he wrote a piece for The Atlantic, which is kind of heartbreaking. It's called "An Extinction Event for America's Restaurants. The Post-Pandemic Dining Experience Will Be Unrecognizable." He does it in the format of almost a diary where he kind of looks ahead, like what might my eating experience be in the summer of 2020? What might it be like in 2021? And what's great about the piece is he talks about the place of the restaurant in the urban experience of the 21st century. Tom, you and I have had so many like wonderful evenings at restaurants. It is a place where you convene with the people you love. It is, to a certain extent, you often define your neighborhood by its restaurant offerings.
Yep.
You can chart a neighborhood's character by its restaurant offerings. And by the way, that's whether or not it is the, in my neighborhood, the burrito place that's been there 80 years, or it's, a new place where young chefs have tried to make a foothold in an expensive market. And it's a heartbreaking, thought-provoking piece. It's really about what this might all be like. Are we entering a world where when you and I go to dinner next, the server's wearing a mask? Where, he imagines a moment where the bartender coughs and the entire restaurant sort of like, ears prick up and then there's this moment of tension before you return to your meal. Lacking the energy of a full restaurant, will we be looking at a world where tables have to be farther apart? And while I don't think anybody loves a restaurant that's too cramped, I think sometimes the energy of going out to eat is those people right next to you. There's an energy in the room, the way there's a packed house in an arena, right? And it's really worth reading. It's in The Atlantic. It's from a June issue, and I highly recommend it. Both for its beauty and its heartbreak. It's a great piece of writing and reporting. And this is from Matt Golding.
Awesome. Can't wait to read that. And this has been I really like this episode, just not just with the French legends in that room, but kind of awesome to see Kevin Gillespie sitting at that table and some of the humanity just popping through the screen there, how cool that must have been for him. So really good. That's about all I have on this episode, and I can't wait to see what Tom spits out and which dish he was.
For Tom Haverstroh, this is Kevin Ornovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.